From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project. Here we are for another week of commentary, analysis, and even when we do our very best, we might even get some insight into the news media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, the editor of the Times Union, ostensibly your host, here with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Dr. Shartok, great to see you.
Hello. I was wondering, when you said ostensibly the host, yes. Was that a shot?
Yes. And Kaylin Brown, professor of communication, head of the journalism faculty at the College of St. Rose.
Hello, Rex. Hello,
long-time
Alan.
Long-time reporter before that, so she brings street cred as well as academic stuff, and it means that I'm the only person in the room without a PhD.
So I have a question
lonely
for you.
There.
I have a question for you, Kaylin, and that is, do you find that, since you're the head of the journalism program, that when you say something, they have to do it?
That never happens. And it's the communications program.
Oh, I see.
And we have a journalism concentration and a bunch of other concentrations. I try to ask my students to do work. My colleagues and I work as a team.
So well, that's an interesting question.
We don't tell each other to do anything. We talk about ways to collaborate and make things move forward.
Now, far be it from me to make trouble, but I too, you know, served. I was a political scientist at New Paltz for 40 years, and at SUNY, I was in the communication program.
At the University of Albany.
Yes, SUNY at the University of Albany. And I was very fascinated by that because there was always a little bit of, I sensed, they'll all call in and say this isn't true, dissonance between the communication people and the more applied journalism people.
You think?
Well, naturally, I think that my discipline is the most important
one,
but so does each, of course, but each of us would be a defender of the discipline with which we have expertise.
Well, one would be wrong and one would be right.
Because there you have it.
It's academia.
As all good mothers would say.
We defend our turf. That's a wonderful thing. Ah, yes. So anyway, we have a couple of readers who write in. A listener, in Pelham, Mass. Says, I've just listened to Media Project number 1379. Considering the topic of sexual harassment allegations in the media, why was there no woman on the panel? Shame on you. You have lost all credibility to talk on this topic. It was a day when it happened. There were three men on this panel when we needed to address the issue. And I'm sorry, that is set up in advance. There was no woman on the panel. So I guess we shouldn't have talked about it until you got here, right?
Well, no, because it keeps happening and we shouldn't stop talking about it. So as long as these stories keep percolating up, whoever's on the panel should talk about it. And if that was how the panel was set up, thank you for addressing it.
Well, thank you. We will talk about it a little bit more since you're here, as a matter of fact. Here's another interesting notion. A listener in Randolph, Vermont, Judith, says, good show. Thank you. But I believe that Rex Smith seemed about to tell a story about North Korea was interrupted by both Alan and Ira Fussfeld. Perhaps I misheard, but it sounded somewhat obnoxious to me. Dr. Shartok, would you defend yourself?
Well, anything that I've ever done to in any way tick you off, Rex, or to in any way, you know, stop you from your mouth.
Okay, thank you very much. That's enough.
I want to apologize.
Thank you very much. Anyway, we always welcome your letters on matters of substance as well as style. Media at WAMC.org is how you can reach us. On Morning Joe, the MSNBC program, Joe Scarborough said, talking about the Texas shooting, the 26 people killed in Sutherland Springs, Texas. We've got to stop, as members of the media, revealing the names of these mass shooters. I want to know their background, why they did it, but it makes no sense in this era of copycat mass shootings for the media to give somebody's name. Does the cable media culture, talk radio culture, online culture, don't they just create more mass shooters in the future?
Well, I don't think the media are creating mass shooters, no. I do understand the question, though. It makes perfect sense to think about how do we pay attention to this without making people encouraged by it. Why that would happen, I think, is a question of mental health. The Poynter Institute came out recently reminding the public of why public officials and advocates of victims often ask journalists to not name individuals, but they reminded readers, listeners, viewers of the media that it's important to name these people because it provides context for the audience, and also it gives information that as an aggregate can amount to something of consequence. And so it's important to share that information, but as is pointed out by the Poynter Institute, good editing can make a difference in how that information is presented.
Good editing in the sense of not glorifying the shooter, but explaining
exactly
who the shooter is. Because when you name an individual, you give the context for the backstory, you kind of help identify trends and prevent misinformation. You know, this is often the case when you're reporting on crimes. If you don't name the perpetrator, you lead to suspicion that other folks may be the perpetrator. By naming someone, you actually rule out other potential perps.
And we have an obligation to accuracy, so it's important to give that information. And were you to withhold the information and not name the person who was the shooter, then the reader, the listener, the viewer is going to be asking questions. It will be in the minds of people. Our obligation is to deliver answers, not just raise questions.
There's a University of North Carolina psychologist who also wrote a column in the New York Times, Zeynep Tufekci, who said this, that what you ought to hold back, he said, is reporting of details such as the type of gun, the ammunition, the angle of attack, and the protective gear the killer might have worn, because such detailed reporting can give the next killer a concrete roadmap. What do you think about that?
Well, today I was watching very early in the morning, probably 3 o'clock in the morning, watching the CBS, and they did an in-depth story about how something like 75% of the airports are not doing their job screening people when they come into the airport. Now, I'm sitting there thinking, hey, you know, they're giving somebody an idea here who might not have had it that they have a free pass, you know, to put a bomb or a gun or a knife somewhere. So this is always the issue. I know that in my house, and I'm going on a little long here, we always want to know who the dastardly person is who did something and why they may have done it. So I think it's important to name them, and I think it's important for reporters to do background. In the case of some of these recent ones, it's been extensive, but in order to give us an insight into what kind of people are out there and what they're doing.
I think it's absolutely true, and I also don't object. In fact, I think that it's really important for the media to report what weapons were used, how they were obtained, not, you know, specifically here's how you buy them, but how the killer came to have them. Because it needs to continue the conversation. There's a great debate about gun control in this society.
Okay.
It is not appropriate to squelch the debate. It's appropriate to report on it and let people speak their minds about it, one side or the other. At Fox and Friends, the favorite news program of the President of the United States, apparently the co-host there was bashing Barack Obama in the aftermath of the Texas shooting for talking about the need to reduce, quote, the weaponry in our midst. Those are the words of President Obama. And the co-host was saying, how dare he talk about such a thing at this point? Well, you talk about it because it's a relevant issue.
Yeah.
At what point don't you?
I think that's very well taken. I think there are some things in this society, Rex, that just engender tremendous friction. And one of them, maybe the biggest, is guns.
Mm-hmm.
But one way to come to some solution about gun control is to get reporting out there and shared, because you can't come to any solutions without information.
Absolutely. Got to give credit, by the way, in the Texas tragedy, the San Antonio Express News, the nearest large newspaper, did extraordinary reporting day after day. And that is where you really have the benefit of a strong news team. When you have something happen in your community, and you need to have people who are ready to go. In the decline of local news staffs as a result of the digital revolution, there is a danger that a lot of this good coverage won't happen. You'll just have the people flying in and then flying out and leaving behind the stories that don't come in quickly.
So let me ask both of you a question about this. We do know that there's been massive layoffs in the print media. But those layoffs, I keep hearing from good folks like you, are often people who have religiously covered the Board of Education meetings in a particular area, or, you know, a local town council meeting, where those reporters aren't available. So when you marshal your resources, you know, both of you, is it that that's what goes first and that the big investigative teams or the major reporters are left to handle the big stories. I keep coming back to the story of the Berkshire Eagle right now, who are putting on a lot of new people because they have a new team of people who have a lot of money who have done that. But there's a major story in the Berkshires, where I live, that won't go away, and that has to do with the deaccessioning of the art in the Berkshire Museum, the selling of prized Rockwells, which could sell for as much as $40 or $50 million. And people, including myself, are furious about the whole thing, and you can't get enough of it. And they have a wonderful investigative reporter, this guy Larry Parnes, who is doing this terrific work on this, and I'm sure they're paying him a lot of money, you know, to get him to stay in this place. But then you have the people who used to be going to Board of Education meetings and covering them religiously. And by the way, I turn the television on and I watch the Board of Education on the television, you know, all the time.
That's a useful way to get that information.
Right.
Our students in the classroom are still attending city council meetings and city planning board meetings and historic resource commission meetings. We have them go to those so that some eyeballs are on what our public officials are doing. And fortunately, because of our student collaboration with the Times Union, the Hearst Corporation kindly has us writing for the Pine Hills blog, and our students' stories about Albany government are getting posted there. I would love to see more of that everywhere so that more local journalism is produced continuously and people know what's happening with their governments.
So, you know, Alan, the answer to your question, which originally started with the question of do you go first for the people doing the hyper-local stories, it's just that there are fewer people in newsrooms, and so you can't cover everything. When we had a full newsroom, one reporter might cover a couple of towns. Skodak and East Greenbush might be a complete beat. And now we have one reporter to cover an entire county's local governments. That is, one county's local governments is covered by one reporter, and where there may be 7 or 10 towns there. So that's the difficulty. The other thing is that if you talk to readers about what they want, what they will tell you, what all the focus groups and all the surveys say, we want watchdog and investigative reporting on state and local government. So you need to fulfill that role, and that is what's unique. You know, nobody else is doing that in our community than we are, so we have to keep that going. It's just that there aren't enough people to cover all the towns. You know, the Times Union is the dominant medium in a 16-county area. We have 4 counties as our predominant core, you know, circulation area, and that's really, we can't cover everything there.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting because Professor Brown has just told us that her students are cooperating with the Times Union blog to put information onto the blog that in previous times, go back 10 years, may have been in the paper. Is there something to be discussed there?
Well, reporters had it in the paper. I'm a little bit nervous about putting in the paper content written by 18-year-old students.
Learning
this
journalists.
This is the point. Yeah, they need to have the opportunity to make mistakes, to have Professor Brown correct their errors and say, look at what you did. This is not fair. So I'm a little bit nervous about saying, yeah, we're going to pick that up and put it in the paper just because somebody was there who's
actually
learning.
The point I was trying to make is the differentiation, because we have a new innovation called blogs.
Well,
which you sponsor.
A new innovation 20 years ago, yes.
And that's just the platform. We actually don't use it as a blog. We're sort of unique that way because there are no opinions in the content that's posted by the students. It's strictly news coverage. It's either a feature story or a breaking story or meeting coverage. We do need more coverage of places in the hinterlands, if you would call it that. I remember at the Troy Record when I started out, my beat was Scaticoke.
Wow.
Learning how to spell it and learning how to get there. And that this was one beat. Scaticoke, the city of Rensselaer, no ear in Rensselaer, and Brunswick and North Greenbush. That was my beat. And every day I went to all those police stations for the Troy Record. I went to all their meetings. I worked more than 12 hours every day for 3 years, and I had no weekends off. It was a great, great job. It was a learning experience I will never forget, and I recommend for everyone. But it reminds me that I think about it all the time, that since the presidential election and we learned that a lot of people are feeling alienated for lack of coverage, those days in Scaticoke, which the meetings were held at the firehouse at the time, it was a very Republican community and people appreciated that coverage, but they have been left by the wayside because there aren't the resources in newsrooms to cover a place like Scaticoke. So where we once had our finger on the pulse of how people in Scaticoke felt, We don't have that now because who's to cover Scaticoke? Although there is the Mechanicville Express out there, and there's some other small...
Little weeklies,
but even that is a struggle for some weeklies.
I love that, Mechanicville Express. That is a terrific name. however, I did want to say to you, as an aside, that someday we'll talk again, we've done it often, about the idea that your students never express an opinion, they just cover it straight. And I would be one of those people who would maintain there is no such thing as just covering it straight. Just the way you put the sentence, where you put the paragraph, what the headline says becomes indicative of a preference.
Absolutely. I agree with all of that. But they don't say, I think this should happen, or, you know, the ranting that goes on more now than ever.
And that's really hard to teach a young student. We see this all the time when we get college students. They want to write their opinions. They basically want to write their opinions about local music, entertainment,
exactly.
Performers,
music.
And athletes.
Music.
Yes. And they think that this is journalism. And to give people training in the importance of civic affairs and how, as best they can, Alan, I think you're right, that there's always their implicit biases that we all bring to every conversation. But as best they can, to teach them to do straightforward reporting, to be fair, to try to ascertain whether something can be verified before you put it into print. Those are important principles. That's what's the difference between journalism that we try to practice and flackery and public relations.
The old-fashioned boring way.
And yes. learning how to include multiple sources and multiple viewpoints and not the likely ones that are always relied on, which has hurt and undermined trust in media. So it's important that journalists and journalism students are learning to get a variety of voices included in their stories and that you're not going back to the same people over and over again. There are a lot of people who want to be heard.
Well, yeah, but a couple of things here. Number one, we always have to be careful about what we call false equivalency, meaning that if somebody's on one side, you always have to have somebody on the other side. The classic remark always is, what was the other side of the Holocaust? You know, I
right.
mean, was there really another side? Number two, there are some people, Doctor, who really are, in fact, experts. I mean, let's face it, we just had a big story in New York State as to whether we should have a constitutional convention. It failed miserably. But the guy who is in favor of it and leading the charge was my pal and yours too, Rex, Jerry Benjamin, who, you know, you couldn't write a story about that without Jerry there. So you could go to the man on the street, MOS, as we say in the biz, and say, what do you think about a constitutional convention? Put him in. But Jerry Benjamin is a distinguished scholar. Blair Horner, who is a top analyst.
But you have the experts, but your journalism is failing if you only quote those middle-aged white guys. And you really need to then expand your horizon. You may include the experts, but you need to have a diversity of viewpoints if you want to have an accurate report. You know, that is not to say that you don't turn to experts for commentary on expert issues. But if you want to give people a view of what the general public is thinking about that, you don't just go to the same kind of people. You need diversity.
No, I can respect that, Rex, coming from a middle-aged white guy.
But I would also say,
call me middle-aged, given
as someone who's not a guy, I'll say the following. So the sidedness point, Alan, that you brought up was intentionally avoided by me. I do not say get both sides because that, in fact, builds in tension that is not necessary. Viewpoints, multiple viewpoints, saying sidedness automatically creates a conflict. I don't think that's productive.
Excellent point. So listen, we promised that we would
stick together. Yeah.
We promised that we would get to the issue of the continuing coverage of the sexual harassment issue. Kaylin, since we were scolded for having men talking about the issue, tell us, how do you think the media has done in handling the issues that have arisen in the aftermath of the Harvey Weinstein allegations?
Overall, I think the media is doing a solid job of including multiple voices again on the issue of sexual harassment in the workplace, because at the focus, that is the question, sexual harassment in the workplace. I think we have come a long, long way since the time of Clarence Thomas when this issue first really came into the mainstream media. I do remember an employee of a huge employer in our market who contacted the Times Union to describe her sexual harassment lawsuit against her employer, a publicly held corporation in Schenectady. And I had put together this story, and I was working on the business desk at the time, but we held the story because there was some trepidation about writing this sexual harassment story, even though a lawsuit had been filed.
Wow.
The moment the Clarence Thomas story broke, I was encouraged to go back and re-report some of the story. Was it within months? It was very close in proximity. So at first, it was sort of being submarined, that story. But once the Thomas story came out, all of a sudden my story became more valid.
But you use the word which I find fascinating, which is trepidation. So what was the trepidation in dealing with this?
I don't know if it's because I had a male editor. I don't know. I don't know if I was on a business desk as a woman. I can't speak to that. I was a lot younger then and knew a lot less than I know now.
But the trepidation came from your superiors.
Exactly right. Exactly right. There was concern that publishing that story would be problematic. But it got published, and that was a beautiful
eventually
thing.
You know, it's interesting. You raise an issue of how the news media often will not recognize an individual story as significant until it becomes part of a broader piece. I think allegations of sexual misconduct by Catholic priests were rare for so many, well, for decades, for generations. You might hear tales of this, but there wouldn't be stories about it until suddenly it was blown open, as we all know, by the Boston Globe really did.
Sure.
The reporting that opened the floodgates and led to this revolution worldwide on this issue. And so there is, I think, a tendency in mainstream media in particular, but also I think it's true of the those who consider themselves to be alt publications, that issues gain credence, they gain resonance when journalists can see other people around them doing the same story. I'm
so
not saying
comfort.
This is good, but there's some, yeah.
There's,
yeah.
There's comfort, we can do this now. I mean, well, I remember yeah. when Trump started to lie every day.
When was the
old?
Start?
Was
I question the word start.
Yeah, well,
what do you mean start?
And there was a big debate in the newspapers and everywhere else as to whether we could use the word lie as opposed to he was misinformed or he was wrong, and we checked it out. So now nobody has a problem with calling him a liar,
well,
which
I
is what he
know.
Deserves.
I think that's still the policy at NPR. I think they don't use the word. That was laid down by Mike Oreskes, by the way, speaking of the sexual harassment allegations when he was running NPR News, that he did not want the word lie used. He wanted it just to be described rather than characterized. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
That bothered me a great deal, not because I don't understand the issue, but it bothered me a great deal because NPR takes indirectly money from the government. And we're talking on an NPR station right now. NPR doesn't own us. Theoretically, we own them, but that's another whole story. We'll take another hour on that one.
But just another layer of the sexual harassment question.
Yeah.
In addition to the fact the media is covering it and doing a good job following up on
sure.
it, and its coverage is resulting in more people coming out to talk about it, there is a question of management within the actual corporations where incidences of sexual harassment have been claimed. So they need to apply the sexual harassment in the workplace criteria to themselves because they are not immune from the issues that come forth in the workplace. And it happens in a lot of workplaces, but it should be dealt with as a human resources issue and as a civil rights issue, and it's not just a story.
Mm-hmm. Actually, credit the Washington Post, Paul Fahey, the reporter, for pointing out rather before NPR did that NPR senior management was aware of multiple harassment complaints by women against its top newsroom executive during the past 2 years, but took no action to remove him from his job until news reports about his conduct appeared elsewhere. So I think that gets to your point that it's not just a news story, it's also an internal issue for news organizations as well.
And right. So my last issue on that, and I know we have to go, is that thank God for the New York Times and the Washington Post, because often they have the resources, they're less worried about being sued, they can defend themselves very well, and once that floodgate is opened by either of those two august institutions, other people follow.
Which began on a yoga mat when Emily Steele went out to California to meet with one of the Fox News guests who had been the original person that she got on record with her name saying, "I was sexually harassed by Bill O'Reilly."
All right, that is it for this week. Thanks for joining us, Kalen Brown, Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith. We are the Media Project. We'll see you next week.
Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.